The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So I have to be honest with you, this is a rather difficult topic. We've just entered the month of Adar. Adar, on the one hand, is the last of the months of the Hebrew calendar, the first being Nisan, which is next month, which is the first month that was given to the Jewish people as a nation, Chodesh Hazeh Lachem. It's actually the first mitzvah that we were given as a Jewish people. And therefore, when you count the months from the perspective of the nation, as opposed to, as you know, sort of counting it from the perspective of the individual, which is beginning with Rosh Hashanah, but from the perspective of the nation, we got out of Egypt, and we began our journey as a Jewish people, and therefore Nisan, the month of Passover, that's the first month, and so Adar is the last month, right? And when you enter the month of Adar, the Talmud in Tanit, in the Tractate of Tanit, tells us, Marbim b'simcha, you abound in joy. You know, there's just more simcha, more joy. First of all, that's a difficult question in general, given that the month of Adar was not such a simple month. The first half of the month, the Jewish people were waiting to be annihilated. But even more so, I think, this year. I want to dedicate this class to the 8 boys who were killed on Thursday night in a brutal, I don't even know what to call it. It's just more than a terrorist attack. It was a massacre. Yochai Lifshitz, Yehonadav Hirschfeld, Roy Roth, Avram David Moses, who is the son of a friend of mine and who was a friend of my son's, Segev Pniel Avichael, who grew up here in Efrat and lives in Neve Daniel, right down the corner, Yonatan Yitzchak Eldar, Doron Meherte, and Neria Cohen. Very difficult. How do you enter the month of Adar with such a Rosh Chodesh, such a new month present? And so the first of all is just, before we even get into this, is what that line means. What does it mean? Mishnichnas Adar, marbim b'simcha. That when you enter the month of Adar, that there's a multiplicity of joy. So before we get into that, we are actually beginning a new book. Okay? We finished the portion of Pkudei, which is the last portion of the book of Exodus, and we're about to start. This week we really start the book of Vayikra. It's interesting that the book of Pekudei, the end of the book of Exodus, which is Ele Pekudei Mishkan, these are those items that were counted among the Mishkan. You know, there's an idea traditionally, Kabbalistically, that every portion is not just accidental. That anything the Jewish people needs to learn in a particular week, all the events that occur to the Jewish people in a particular week are contained within that portion. And it's not accidental that on a Thursday night, that 8 boys were counted and were taken to the heavenly court, and whatever that means, that they were the Pkudim. They were those counted. The word Pkudei also means to be remembered. Vayifkod Hashem at Sarah, and God remembered Sarah when he gave her Yitzchak. And so these are the boys that are remembered. But now we begin sort of the week of Shiva. This is when the shock wears off. This is when you begin to deal with it. What is the week of Vayikra? What is the book of Vayikra? Right? So it's interesting that generally speaking, this book, the book of Vayikra, is associated with the sacrifices. Right? This is sort of that the beginning, now that the Mishkan, now that the tabernacle is built. So now this book, Sefer Vayikra, tells us what we're supposed to do there. And that's why a large portion of the book of Vayikra has all the laws, all the halachot of the korbanot, of the sacrifices, right? And we need to understand what that means. You know, on the one hand, there's an obvious connection, and everybody here is talking about, you know, that these 8 boys were sacrificed on the altar of, and then fill in the blank, depending on your political perspective. Whose sacrifices? Why sacrifices? Why do we need sacrifices? Haven't we given enough sacrifices? Right? It becomes even more challenging when you really understand what the word sacrifice means, what the karban means, sort of in Jewish tradition. Because, you know, the Jews have a very different perspective of the word karban. You know, most people translate this word as a sacrifice. But if you do a little sort of guesswork in Latin, fis or fais means to make, and sacra is holy, right? Like the word sacred. So sacrifice or sacrifice is really to make holy, right? And so on one level, the sacrifice is that which was somehow made holy, right? Of course, that would demand a meaning for the word holy, but that's for another discussion. And for many of us, sacrifice brings to mind, you know, harming oneself or being harmed so that others will benefit. Right, if you're a baseball fan, the sacrifice fly where you hit the ball way up high in the air, knowing it'll be caught, knowing that you'll be out at the plate, and that you won't get to get on base, but that the amount of time it takes the person catching the ball to get it will allow a runner on third base to run home. So you're sacrificing yourself in order to bring the runner home. And never mind the more obvious connotations, right? And the truth is that this idea of a sacrifice transmuted by Christianity has become a central tenet. But the danger in concentrating on that idea alone, right, on assuming that that's what sacrifice is all about, is that it portrays a sinner as weak, right? I'm unable to change my behavior in a way that can enable me never to sin again, so I need to suffer. I need to cause the animal to suffer, right? But there's another understanding of the word korban, and this would seem to be the essence of the word in Judaism, certainly in Jewish tradition and in Jewish commentaries. The Ramban, for example, Nachmanides, who points out that the word korban comes from the word karov, which is repeated many times in this week's parsha, right? The root of resh, vet, kuf, right? Or I should say kuf, resh, vet, right? The whole process of bringing and offering a korban, mistranslated as sacrifice, is that it's supposed to bring me nearer to Hashem, nearer to God, right? And when you start to look at the laws and the traditions of the korbanot, so then that would mean that this is a whole different process. How does taking an animal and walking it into the sanctuary and offering it up on an altar somehow bring me closer to God? I would think, certainly in our modern society, that if we were actually to rebuild the temple, that it would do anything but bring us closer to society. In fact, there's a very interesting dialogue that went on about 150 years ago with Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was one of the major proponents of the return of the Jewish people to Tzion, right? That it was time to go home. And among the many sort of halachic and theological discussions that he had, one of them was a letter that he wrote to the Rothschild family, the head of the Rothschild, Lord, I think Baron Edmund de Rothschild, in which he proposed that the Jewish people could purchase a plot of land on the Temple Mount and renew the custom of sacrifices, and that this would be a tremendous merit to the Jewish people and would hasten the coming of Mashiach, of Messiah. And he proposed that there were actually three challenges to this own plan, right? There were three sort of problems, right? The first problem was that the Jewish people essentially are tamei, they are impure. So how can you offer up a sacrifice, right? The second problem was, we don't have a temple. Can you offer up a sacrifice without a temple? And then the third challenge was, since we're not really 100% sure any of our Kohanim, any of our priests are Kohanim, then maybe we have no Kohanim to offer the sacrifice. At which point he went through sort of the sources and explained why each of these three was not a problem. First of all, there's a halakha, tuma dchuya betzibur, that whenever you have the majority of the Jewish people are impure, or in this case, have had some contact with death, right, that the need of the congregation to offer the sacrifice over or outweighs the problem, the challenge of most of them being impure. And therefore, you're allowed to offer up a sacrifice in such an event. Now, you're not allowed to offer an individual sacrifice, like if you have your own sin offering. But, you know, for example, the Paschal Lamb, the Korban Pesach, right? Or the festivals of, the sacrifices of the festival, or the atonement sacrifice on Yom Kippur. So even though we're all impure, we're allowed to offer that up because the mitzvah to offer up that korban outweighs the fact that we're impure. And then he points out and proves that that even though the Kohanim today are in some level of doubt, the fact is that if a Kohen, if a priest's family has assumed that they're Kohanim for a long period of time, we're allowed to assume for purposes of this that they're Kohanim. And the third issue, which is that we don't have a Mikdash, he proves absolutely that that in fact one does not need a Mikdash, a temple, to offer up certain sacrifices. As a matter of fact, when the second temple was built, when the second Beit HaMikdash was built, it's very clear in the book of Ezra that during the first few years, before the temple was built, they built a Mizbeach, they built an altar, and they offered up sacrifices before the temple was built. For certain sacrifices, you don't even need the Mikdash, a Mizbeach is enough. An altar is enough, and whereas sort of building the temple is a pretty expensive proposition, building an altar, a Mizbeach, is not. And so he proposed that they purchase a small plot of land on the Temple Mount, and that the Jews build a Mizbeach, and that they could offer up sacrifices. And eventually he sent this as well to some of the great authorities of the day. First it went to Rabbi Akiva Eger, and then Rabbi Akiva Eger passed it on to the Chasam Sofer, his son-in-law, Rav Moshe of Pressburg, and they concluded, in fact, that one could do this. The Chasam Sofer believed that only the Paschal Lamb, but that's a detail. You could actually build an altar. Now, 150 years ago, this was simply a matter of money. Today, buying a plot of land to build an altar on the Temple Mount would be a lot more complicated than the land. But it's interesting as an aside to note that we sort of have this idea in our heads that the impediment, that what sort of keeps us from a return to some of the rituals of yesteryear is that we have no temple and whatever. The truth is, you don't need a temple. We just need an altar. And you only need a small plot of land. And you wouldn't even need a plot of land where the golden dome of the Dome of the Rock is or where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is. You could take an open piece of space. Which means that this has become a political issue, which is a fascinating detail. But of course the question becomes, right? I mean, I've always felt that the reason that that plan fell through was not because it wasn't practical, but because the Jewish people weren't ready for it. The real question is not whether you could build an altar. The real question is how many Jews care less about an altar. When was the last time anybody who said in the Shemona Esrei, in the 18th benedictions prayer, Ritzei, you know, that we dream that there'll be a time that we come back and build a temple, you know, did Jews really think about that? And of course, by the way, a temple is much more than just a building. This is meant to be a place where Jews can come together and ultimately people can come together, where the differences between us aren't important, where it doesn't matter if you're left-wing or right-wing or Sephardic or Ashkenazic or rich or poor. Everybody comes together. We are so desperately in need of such a place, right? But we don't think about it. It's not high on our agenda. And of course, if we don't want something enough, there's no reason it should come into the world. But the question that we began with, so what exactly is the sacrifice? Why is this such a critical piece? Why are we meant to be spending the next 10 to 12 weeks studying the laws of sacrifices? And then I'll ask you another question. If already you're starting a book with the laws of sacrifices, right? So it's an interesting question. Where would you start? Like, what halacha, what law would you begin with? So, very interesting. The first verse of Vayikra, Vayikra El Moshe, it's interesting that in the Torah scroll, the Aleph in the word Vayikra is small. And that has to do with the theological sort of battle, to some degree, that was going on between Moshe's humility and Hashem's reality. Because the word Vayikra without the Aleph spells the word Vayaker, like Mikre, like a happenstance. It just happened. And the word Vayikra, of course, means that God called Moshe. And Moshe didn't feel comfortable with the fact that it would be written down in the Torah that God himself calls Moshe. Because who am I that God should have to call me? And so there's an allusion here to the humility, which is what made Moshe the great man that he was. Certainly if we could take those three words and impart that lesson to today's Jewish political and maybe even rabbinic leadership, we'd all be much better off. It's not a given today that leaders, unfortunately, have to have as a part of who they are a certain given humility, something we need to work on. But okay, so God calls Moses, and Moshe comes to him, and then God says in Pasuk Bet, in the second Pasuk, in the second verse, Daber al bnei Yisrael ve'amarta alehem, Adam ki yakriv mikhem. Speak to the Jewish people and say unto them, right, a man who will offer from amongst you a korban. Okay? And then there's discussion, you know, sort of what korbanot and what sacrifices and whatever. So Rashi here makes a fascinating point. What do we learn from this verse? Right? So listen to what Rashi says. It says, Adam ki akriv mikem korban. A man who should come, and Adam, of course, is a human being, not just a man or a woman. There's just no translation in English. Keshe akriv, when a man offers, bekorbanot nedava diberanyan. So then he says, Adam. Lama ne'emar. Why does it say Adam? Why does he use the word Adam? The word Adam is a much more general term. Why doesn't it say Ish? Right? Ish ki akriv mikem. Ish ki amut boel. You find that word, a man. Why the word Adam? So listen to what Rashi says. This is unbelievable. Ma Adam harishon lo hikriv min hagezel. Because just as Adam, the original first man, did not offer up from stolen goods, he couldn't have, she'akol haya shelo, because everything belonged to him, af atem lo takrivu min hagezel. So too, you have to be careful that when you offer up a sacrifice, that it shouldn't be from stolen goods. You don't give tzedakah from stolen money. You don't offer up a sacrifice from a stolen animal. If it's stolen, it's not yours to offer. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that's not an important halacha. But why is that the beginning of Sefer VaYikra? Why is that the beginning of the entire third book? The third book, by the way, being the central book of the Torah, with two on either side. The essence of the service of God is contained in this book. And this whole book begins... Just make sure that the sacrifice you offer isn't from stolen goods. That's such an important halacha. That's where we have to start. And by the way, there's an interesting premise that's assumed here. And that is that that Adam owned everything in the world. Well, now that's an interesting idea. I would have thought God owned everything in the world. In fact, every Friday night, we say as a part of the liturgy right after the silent Amidah, the silent prayers, we say, right, Kone Shamayim V'aretz. Hashem has acquired, Hashem owns everything, the heavens and the earth. So that means that if Adam owns anything, it's because Hashem has given it to him. And of course, in truth, if you have what you have only because Hashem gave it to you, you don't really own anything. So what does that mean? Where is that coming from? Why is this idea that Adam couldn't have offered a stolen sacrifice, and therefore that we should be careful not to offer a stolen sacrifice? What does that have to do with the beginning of a Yikra? Why is that this important halacha? Why is that the beginning? So I'll tell you an amazing story. I don't know if you really saw the papers, but, you know, this Thursday night tragedy, this Rosh Chodesh Adar massacre in Merkaz Arav, in the yeshiva, which hit really at the heart of Tzionut, of Zionism. You couldn't pick a more painful paradigm than high school kids who are studying Torah at 9:45 at night, on a Thursday night, when most teenagers their age are out partying, because in most schools in Israel, Friday is the Sunday. So it's the equivalent of like Saturday night. And they're actually sitting in study halls learning Torah. That's just unbelievable. So a friend of mine, Moise, who lives here in Efrat, he comes to my Shabbat morning class every week. And he got an aliyah. And you don't think about who... I saw in the aliyah that he was like visibly... I mean, I was standing right next to him. Something was going on. He was visibly moved. And the Gabbai announced that, you know, we should all take a moment to appreciate how blessed we are because Moise was in Merkaz Arav on Thursday night. So I went over to him afterwards to talk to him. He goes every Thursday night to a class in Merkaz Arav, and this Thursday night was no exception. And they go to the shiur, and it's like, you know, it usually starts around 9:45, and at the end of the class, at the end of the discussion, so then they all pray the evening service together, Maariv, and there's usually like 15 guys, and they all come together and they study. For some reason, this Thursday night, there were only 9 guys there. A bunch of guys didn't show. So because there were 9 guys there, at the end of the class, instead of just starting Maariv, the evening service, they had to find a 10th man for a minyan. And for some reason, it just took them a few minutes. They couldn't find a 10th guy. One guy had an excuse, another boy didn't hear them. Just very strange. Can you imagine? You're in a yeshiva, hundreds of people sitting and learning, and you can't find a 10th guy for a minyan. That's just odd. So finally, they found like a high school boy. And he came in with them to Daven Maariv. Like, they asked him to come and join them just to be there so that they could have a 10th man. As they were concluding the Maariv service, literally, the rabbi who gave the class was davening, was leading the services, and he got to the final Kaddish. And he was in the middle of the last verse of Kaddish. Right? Ose shalom bimromav hu yase shalom. Hashem who makes peace, let him make peace. And just at that exact instant, the machine gun fire started. And it took them a minute. They didn't realize. They thought, you know, that it's the night of Adar, the night of Rosh Chodesh Adar, the new month of Adar. In yeshiva circles, that's a night to, like, you know, party and you know, in a healthy way, and dance, and they have bands, and there was actually a band in the yeshiva, and they thought it was firecrackers. It took them a minute or two to realize that the firecrackers weren't stopping. And then somebody looked out the window and saw some of what was going on and realized there was gunfire. So they turned down the lights, they turned off the lights, and they barricaded the door, because, you know, that's one way to look at it. You know, everybody stays in their place. There's less possibility for people to get, you know, caught. And they braced themselves against the tables and chairs. They had no guns. They had no protection. They had nothing. And of course, the firing went on for 10 minutes until finally, you know, an officer who lives in the area who just finished putting his children to sleep ran into the yeshiva. Incredibly, there were two policemen standing outside the gates of the yeshiva and told him not to go in there because there's shooting going on. Can you imagine? There's two policemen standing outside and they said, don't go in because there's shooting going on. So he pushed them out of the way and he ran in, and he, along with another fellow on the roof with a handgun, managed to put an end to this terrorist. And he's telling me this story. It's Shabbat morning. He starts crying. You know, he just, tears are flowing down his cheeks. And you know, so he asked me, like, how do you, 7 years ago, in the summer of 2001, I was in a Sparrow's pizzeria when a suicide bomber walked in and blew himself up, and I walked out without a scratch. So he wanted to know, so how do you deal with this, and how do you handle this, etc.? And his wife was there, because by this time we were sort of getting ready for the shiur after the class that I give after shul, and I could see in her face exactly how my wife felt 7 years ago. Like, I almost lost my husband, and I got him back, right? And we got into this discussion, and I said, well, you know, the truth is that it was a different experience. Because, you know, God forbid we should never know from such things, but, you know, when a suicide bomber walks in, it's a moment. And then it's over. And then you're just sort of thinking about, you know, how lucky you were to live and whether you should feel guilty. And, you know, you can help with the injured. There's something you can do. To be lying on the floor in a room, you know, with machine gun fire in the halls of the yeshiva for 10 minutes, that's a whole different reality. And mind you, this is a fellow who hadn't done the army, so he's not psychologically prepared for this. And there's a whole level of guilt. You know, at the end of the day, you're a group of adults and you barricaded yourself in instead of running out to try to help the boys. And God forbid not to be, you know, judging such a situation. Nobody can talk, but, you know, I'm sure survivor's guilt will definitely set into these guys. So then we get into this discussion. So how do you deal with the fact that it's the new month of Adar? Right? What do you do with that? Right? So I want to tell you something deep. And I think it relates to the book of Vayikra. And I think it relates to that first Rashi. I think there's a message there. And I think it even relates to what happened on Thursday night. What is Simcha? Now, we've spoken about this before. What is the meaning of joy? What is Simcha? Simcha is purpose. You experience joy. In fact, the reason that the mitzvah to rejoice on the festivals is given specifically in the third festival, the festival of Sukkot, right, the Feast of the Booths, is because that's the end of the agricultural cycle, right? On Pesach, on Passover, we have springtime first plantings. On Shavuot, first fruits, first harvest. But it's Sukkot that sees the end of the harvest when everything comes in. And that's when it makes sense. That whole arduous process of planting and plowing and reaping and harvesting, it all makes sense because it worked because you have your harvest. Right? That's why when we come home one day in redemption, we'll experience joy because the whole long journey will have made sense. So one way of looking of Mishinichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha is that naturally at the end of a year, things become clearer. There's a sense of purpose. You understand what you accomplished this year. This is actually the month for introspection to think about it. In fact, there's a Hasidic idea that Yom Kippurim is a day which is Kippurim. It's meant to be like Purim. Because the introspection of Yom Kippur, which is done in a framework of abstinence, has as its ideal the ability to be introspective on that same level, immersed in the world of the physical, right? And that's one way of looking at Purim, right? In fact, there's a tradition that we drink on Purim. Now, Judaism doesn't believe in getting drunk, and unlike, you know, some other social frameworks, 364 days a year, you're not supposed to get drunk. In fact, even on the night of Passover, of Pesach, when you drink four cups of wine, you're not supposed to get drunk. That's why you're not allowed to drink between the third and fourth cup. It's why you're allowed to drink during the meal, because the Talmud says that if you drink during the meal, you don't really get drunk. Well, that's true. That's at least the idea. So the mitzvah is not to get drunk. The only day of the year when one is allowed to get drunk is Purim. And that, says the Talmud, is because Chayavinish Lemesube Bifuraya Ad Yelo Yada Ben Baruch Mordechai Ve'Arur Haman. Until a person doesn't know the difference between Arur Haman, cursed is Haman, and blessed is Mordechai. So that's an unbelievable halacha. How could it be that you're obligated not to know? Judaism is all about knowledge. So one way of understanding that is because we live in a world where we think that Haman is evil and Mordechai is blessed. We think we know who the righteous are and who the wicked are. We think we know who the heroes are and who the antagonists are. We think we know who saves us and who wants to destroy us. But the whole message of Purim is we have no idea. You know, when the Jewish people started the festival of Purim, the big mess, according to Jewish tradition, is that they all went to the Feast of Achashverosh, right? There was no glatt kosher food at the Feast of Achashverosh, right? They didn't have rabbis getting up to give Talmudic discourses. In fact, Vashti, according to the Medrash, according to Jewish legend, gets killed by King Achashverosh because she refuses to come out before the populace naked. Now, if the queen is being told to come out naked, you can only imagine what's going on with everybody else. Never mind that according to Jewish tradition, they brought out vessels from the temple. Can you imagine a Jew eating unkosher food from dishes that came from the Beit HaMikdash in the temple? It just doesn't get worse than that. We were on the verge of assimilation. We were more Persian than the Persians. In fact, the name Mordechai comes from the Babylonian god inherited by the Persians, Marduch. Is that a Jewish name? The hero of Purim was like Christopher, not Avram Yitzchak. And in the midst of all of this, Ad Delo Yada, we drink to let go, to remember that we think we know, but somehow, sometimes we need to get beyond we know. We need to get beyond what we know. I wonder if that isn't the challenge of Marbim B'Simcha. If we can really access the fact that while we really don't know what we're looking at, to be able to accept that somehow Hashem has a purpose for all this, we're just not necessarily meant to get it. Anybody who thinks that they understand these things, kazin to hate, I wish them luck. I don't claim to understand these things. But, you know, to believe that there is some purpose, that there's something going on, to be able to let go of the question, which is very different from trying to answer it, that would seem to be the essence of Purim, because Purim is the festival where there is no revealed miracle. Purim is the festival of the hidden miracle. That's why the name of God doesn't even appear in the entire book of Esther. In fact, the name Esther reminds us of the word lahastir, seter, the hiddenness, the secrets. And that brings us back to Vayikra, to the Korbanot. And that's the whole message of the book of Vayikra, of the book of Korbanot, is that while we strive to come closer to bring Hashem into our lives, there's a part of us that has to remain distant because we can't completely comprehend, right? And then when you go to that first Rashi, it starts to make sense, because what is Rashi really saying? Rashi is really saying that before you begin, what's the most challenging part of the Korban? See, we live in a society today where we think the most challenging aspect is that you take an animal and you slaughter it. But 3,000 years ago, that wasn't a big deal. That was tame relative to what people were doing on this planet. The real challenge was that you took a piece of your property. I mean, even today, a piece of cattle is worth a lot of money. You can only imagine, relatively speaking, what it was then. You got to take your piece of property. You got to take your $1,000, you know, used car or your $5,000 Jaguar, and you got to take it up to the temple. You got to slaughter it. You got to offer it up. You got to let go. Letting go of your animal is letting go of the physical part of this world, is recognizing that the physical things that we see in this world are to some degree an illusion. That we think we know, we have no idea. We don't really get it. Sometimes we have to let go of how we think the world is meant to run and sense, taste, experience, have an allusion to, get an inkling of the idea that really we don't completely understand this world, and that that's okay. It's a very hard thing to do sometimes, for eight families that sat down last night, Friday night, with an empty seat at their Shabbos table, it was something to do that's, to be honest, beyond my comprehension. And yet at the same time, the Jewish people, as always, have come together. And the Yehi Ratzon Shenizkeh, we should merit, Bezrat Hashem, with all of the pain and all of the challenge, that the time will come that we can put aside all the things that have made us distant from each other and rediscover all the vehicles, all the different ways that we can come close, the essence of the message of the Korban, so that one day perhaps we can be studying together on a rooftop in the old city of Yerushalayim instead of over the phone lines across the United States.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.